All right, tonight we're going to talk about, we'll start a conversation about Amazon Echo. This is, when I say start a conversation, it's because so Natan in Yeshiva a few hours ago, and he's like, wow, a whole shiur about Amazon Echo is very exciting. I'm like, I have no idea what I'm going to say. So starting a conversation because I'm just throwing out ideas. There's a lot more that has to be fleshed out. When it comes to this, as you see, I don't have Mar Makomos prepared for tonight. This was sort of last minute. It happens to be I was learning a sugya in Bava Kama in Yeshiva that relates to Dibur and the effect of Dibur as far as Nezikin is concerned. So I thought, oh, it would be interesting to talk about the effects of Dibur. And then it occurred to me that I think Benji Berg had asked me about Amazon Echo and how it works through Dibur. So I thought, okay, why don't we talk about Dibur as far as Nezikin, Dibur as far as Shabbos, because for those not familiar, it seems that everyone is familiar, but the way it works is it's like a super version of Siri where you call it, you can only call it Alexa, there's no other name that...
You can probably change it. And actually, it's actually less, I think Siri is actually a better technology.
Siri is a better technology?
It doesn't do as much as Siri can.
Really?
Google has one also.
But I thought like you could connect it with your smart house and it will.
Yes, that's true.
Like yeah, you could say, Alexa, turn on the lights. You know, turn the oven on to 350 and play me some, you know, classical music.
You have to buy those things separately.
Okay, but it's theoretically, like everything, you could just walk in and instruct it to do, and add to my shopping list and order me this from Amazon, and you know, like it
will.
Okay.
It doesn't matter.
Maybe you don't know how to use it. So
I argue with it.
So so that's the basic idea of how it works. You call its name, which for some reason is Alexa, and then a little blue LED ring lights up, and then you give it instructions, and you tell it whatever it is that you want to tell it. You ask it to order you something, to buy you something, to turn a light on, to play you music, to give you information, anything that you want. And it, I mean, not anything that you want, but you know, it responds with whatever its capabilities are. So the question is, you know, is this like a malacha on Shabbos? You know, you go into a room and you say, turn on the lights. So the lights turn on, or you do anything that you ask it to do, would that be a violation of a malacha on Shabbos? What if you were to have a technology where it could do damage to people, make a piercing sound that will burst someone's eardrum, and you know, and it makes a sound and person? So did you do that? Is that something that one would be culpable for in Nezikin? And I remembered that a couple of years ago, I was at a wedding and I was sitting next to Rabbi Elchanan Adler, one of the Rosh Yeshiva in YU, and he was telling me that one of his Talmidim had just spent a lot of time looking into what's called BCI technology. Familiar with this? So BCI technology is essentially, the way he explained it to me, is the technology that they use for like making limbs work in amputees. Meaning, if an amputee is getting a prosthetic, so the brain has to talk to the prosthetic limb in order to make the limb work, in order to make the limb do things. So they were thinking that what they've done is they've expanded that to work wirelessly. I mean, if your brain can communicate with a piece of plastic or rubber that's fashioned like a limb that they attach to your body, maybe they can make your brain communicate with things wirelessly, meaning with things that are not attached to your body. And just by thinking something, you can, you know, you think you want the lights to turn on, and the lights will turn on. That's like the next, you know, that's what he was telling me, that's like the next frontier, is that you don't have to actually even say anything. It's not voice activated, it's thought activated, that they can actually connect in that way. Pretty cool. So I said, I'm interested to learn more about it. So he sent me an email with like six different attachments, each one like 40 pages long. So tons and tons of Mar Makomos. And you see that there are so many makoros that may have something to say about this, but like it's all over the place. You know, what's the effect of machshava on in terms of a maisa? You know, being mafresh truma b'machshava. Like you're looking everywhere to try to find, you know, whether machshava, dibur, what these things, and also things that seem magical, that seem not to work at all, that shouldn't work, that never would have worked in any time before the last couple of years. And you have like midrashim and agadatas about things working with sefer yitzira and this kind of thing. So how much can you derive lahalacha from those kinds of discussions, discussions about the man, is it bishul b'shabbos if you're thinking you want the man to taste like medium rare steak? So is that called bishul because it was only mental, or maybe it was verbalized, but you're not actually cooking anything? So you're really reaching in a lot of different directions to try to come to some sort of coherent approach of how to deal with both in terms of Shabbos and in terms of Nezikin, and they may not be the same. The din, what's called the Maisa for Shabbos and what's called the Maisa for Nezikin, may not be the same. What would make you culpable for one and for the other may not be the same. But that's what we generally find in the literature. If you were to ask Gedolei HaPoskim today, you go to this fellow asked, I think, Rav Asher Weiss and Rav J. David Bleich and Rav Schachter. Each one's brain went in different directions and came up with entirely different makoros to try to deal with this issue. So I think we're not there yet in terms of having a clear mahalich of how to deal with it, but we'll talk out some of the makoros, and I, like I said, this will be sort of like a conversation starter. Should we start with Shabbos or start with the makoros of Nezikin? Yeah, we'll start with Shabbos, I guess. There is a machlokas, Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish, in terms of how the Urim V'Tumim functioned. That when the Kohen Gadol wanted to communicate with the Urim V'Tumim, he had a question to ask. So we know that there were the various stones and the Choshen and the letters of the names of the Shvatim. And when you would ask a question, certain letters would sort of pop out. But this machlokas, exactly what would happen? Would only the letters pop out, or would they arrange themselves in order so that you could actually see what the answer is. So there is discussion in the Achronim, if you hold like Reish Lakish that the letters would arrange themselves in order, how are they allowed to consult the Urim V'Tumim on Shabbos? Isn't it a malach of Kosev? Because you're going to go to the Urim V'Tumim, you're going to say, what do we do about this issue? And then all of a sudden the letters are going to form themselves and it's going to make words, and that isn't that a malach of Kosev? So there are basically two approaches in how to deal with this, and along the way dealing with many other issues. Let's introduce another issue as we describe this. Moshe Rabbeinu, according to the Medrash, wrote on the day of his death 13 Sifrei Torah. Pretty impressive feat in its own right. He writes 13 Sifrei Torah on the day of his death. 12 Sifrei Torah, one for each of the Shvatim, and then one that he left in the Aron, in case there would be questions about any sort of Ziyuf in any of the other Sifrei Torah. If anyone were to try to forge something, they could always consult the Sifrei Torah in the Aron. The Rosh in the 10th parak of Maseches Pesachim in Simen Yud Gimel says that Moshe Rabbeinu died on Shabbos. So if he wrote 13 Sifrei Torah on the day that he died, and he died on Shabbos, so was he a Mechal Shabbos? Chas v'shalom, how could you say? It can't be the Moshe Rabbeinu's Mechal Shabbos. Also, he must not have written them. So then, are they Kosher Sifrei Torah? If he didn't write them, what does that mean? That he wrote 13 Sifrei Torah on the day of his death? I mean, if you put the Medrash and the Rosh together, we have a significant problem in explaining what exactly was going on with Moshe Rabbeinu. The fact that he died on Shabbos plays out in Halacha, in our Minhagim. We say Tzidkascha by Shabbos Mincha, because that's a Tzidduk Adin on the Petir of Moshe Rabbeinu. The Ramban, Shulchan Aruch, writes that we're not supposed to, even though we do this, we're not supposed to have a halacha shir in between Mincha and Mariv on Shabbos, because it's Chacham Shemais Beis Midrash Batel. So the Beis Midrash Shal Moshe Rabbeinu is every Beis Midrash in the world, and on Shabbos afternoon between Mincha and Mariv, it's Beis Midrash Batel. That's why people say Chasidus HaTorahs during between Mincha and Mariv, because they don't want to learn. I mean, they don't want to learn halacha in the sense that the Rama writes that one is not supposed to learn halacha. Rav Schachter is very makbid about this. Rav Schachter was kind of upset at me when I told him that we do halacha between Mincha and Mariv. He said, no one else, whatever. So we do what we do. But that's based on the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu died on Shabbos. So how do we reconcile that? So there are two basic approaches. There's a Shlach HaKadosh, it's quoted by the Chassam Sofer, that Moshe Rabbeinu did it through some sort of recitation of Shem Hashem, because obviously physically it's impossible for a person to write 13 Sefer Torah in one day anyway. I mean, even the Gemara that tells us that one of the Amoraim wrote 400 Sefer Torah, so the Gemara says, what? In his lifetime, 400 Sefer Torah. Can't be 400 Sefer Torah in his lifetime. No, he wrote Torah Tzivulon Moshe 400 times. That's what it means. He didn't really write 400 Sefer Torah. It's impossible. So the Gemara dismisses 400 in a lifetime is impossible. 13 in a day? Obviously impossible. So the Chassam Sofer quotes from the Shlach HaKadosh, he did it through saying something, some Shem Hashem, and then the pen picked it, the quill picked itself up, and wrote 13 Sefer Torah. The question, of course, would then be, why are those Sefer Torah kosher? Meaning, Mimanavshach, if it's a Maisa for Ksiva Sefer Torah, it's a Maisa Ksiva with regard to Ksiva Sefer Torah, you can call that a Ksiva Lishma, then it should be a Maisa Ksiva for Chil Shabbos. And if it's not called a Maisa Ksiva for Ksiva Sefer Torah, then it shouldn't be a Maisa Ksiva for Chil Shabbos either. Okay, a problem. The Gemara in Sanhedrin on Daf Kuf Aleph also says, Lochshim Lechishos for Nechash Makrabim B'Shabbos. That if you have a nachash, not a dangerous nachash, it's going to kill somebody. If you have something like that, then obviously you do whatever you can to stop it, then you could be machal Shabbos. But you have, you know, the kind of nachash that the Mishnah talks about in Brachos, that, you know, if it's karuch al akevo, that, you know, don't stop Shmon Esrei in the middle, you know, it's just, you know, you're able to quickly look at the snake and realize, it's not poisonous, it's just annoying. So if you have a nachash that's going to annoy, that's going to bother people, so you could be loch shim lechishos. And Rashi writes in Sanhedrin Daf Kuf Aleph that it's not a problem of tzeda, that even though you're trapping the snake through some sort of statement, through some sort of verbalization, that's not a problem of trapping. So the pashal explanation, if there is a pashal explanation, is that you're not doing the malacha at all. The malacha is, you're saying something and you're sort of punting it to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and saying, Hashem, you know, now that I know the magic words to say, please Hashem, do it, Hashem is then doing it. But you're not actually doing anything at all. It's all through a Maisa Nisim, and therefore it's all, and the same could be said with the Urim V'Tumim, that when you, it's not that you're doing a Maisa of Kosev. You're asking the Urim V'Tumim is responding, that's HaKadosh Baruch Hu acting through the Urim V'Tumim, but that's not a violation from the side of the person who's being lochesh the lechishos. And it could be just in general that metaphysical types of forces that are not within the natural world don't fit into the structure of the dinim of Shabbos or Nezikin. For example, there's a famous piece in the Stipler in Baba Kamen, Sin Memhei, in Kilis Yaakov, he discusses, is one liable, you know, the Torah tells us, the Chumash tells us, that if a person hits a pregnant woman and causes causes her to miscarry, that he's liable to pay for that. You have to pay for that kind of damage. What if, though, the Gemara tells us in Moed Katan that if a person cuts his fingernails and throws it on the floor, and a pregnant woman passes, it's a sakana for a pregnant woman to pass over to walk on the fingernails. That's why the Gemara says that you can cut your fingernails and throw them on the floor of a Beis Medrash, because a woman's not around in the Beis Medrash, so as long as you can do it in a place where there aren't women around. The Gemara says, they might sweep out the Beis Medrash, and then it's going to end up in the street, and a woman's going to walk over the fingernails in the street. So the Gemara says, yeah, but it loses its potency once it's swept away. So as long as you throw it on the floor in the Beis Medrash, you can have the floor of the Beis Medrash full of fingernails, and then when they sweep it out, it's no longer going to be able to do anything. So the Stipler talks about, what if you're not a vicious person, you're not going to go beat up a pregnant woman, but you really, for some reason, want to get back at her, so you throw your fingernails right in front of where she's about to walk, and she miscarries. So are you chayiv to pay for it? So the Stipler says, no. This is a metaphysical thing. This is not something that has any rational explanation. It's not something that you could say you did. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu doing it, you know, through some force. And it's a similar idea to the Urim V'Tumim and this kind of thing, where you're not doing it. There's no explanation of how your words are causing this to happen. It's ki'ilu, you were mispal to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he should do it, and then HaKadosh Baruch Hu did it. That's one mahalik. However, there is an entirely different mahalich that suggests that with the Urim V'Tumim, the reason they were allowed to be shol in the Urim V'Tumim on Shabbos was because it's the Isser of Ksiva on Shabbos, of Kosev on Shabbos, and all the Melachos of Shabbos is an Isser of Melacha. Well, Sasa, Kol Melacha, Asiya is Aser. To do a Maisa Melacha is Aser. But if you're not doing a Maisa, there's no Maisa at all, it just happens on its own, then that's not included in Chil Shabbos. For example, the Gemara Masech Shabbos discusses, let's say you have a Tzvi, that deer that runs into the house, and you're thinking, that deer looks delicious. I'd love to have it for after Shabbos. Or my children always wanted a pet deer or whatever, you know. It's the season or whatever. So you want to catch the deer, but it's Shabbos. So you don't want to violate the Melacha of Tzedah. As it turns out, a guy, your friend, walks right by the doorway of your house. The door is open. It's the only way the deer can get out. He stops right by the doorway. He's just standing in the doorway. He has no idea what he's doing. He's standing in the doorway. Unbeknownst to him, he's trapping the deer, or maybe Benonsi, he does know what he's doing, and he's violating the Melacha of Tzad by standing in the doorway and blocking the deer from leaving. So you think quickly, you stand right behind him. So you now, even when he moves out of the way, you'll still be in the doorway. You'll still be blocking the doorway, and the deer will still be trapped. But you didn't, by positioning yourself where you positioned yourself, you didn't put yourself in a place where you're going to be trapping the deer, because at the time that you stood there, the other guy was there. He was already blocking the deer in. So the deer was already trapped. It wasn't Mechusar Tzedah, it was already Nitzot V'Omeid. It was already trapped, and you're just standing in the doorway as well. So the Gemara says that that's not a Melacha, of Tzedah on Shabbos, because Melacha involves some sort of Maisa. If you're not doing anything, then it can't be called a Melacha. So similarly, you know, when it comes to the man on Shabbos, the Achronim discuss, like we mentioned before, you get a piece of man on Shabbos in the Midbar, you got it from before Shabbos, obviously, but you have man left over to use on Shabbos, and what? You don't want it to taste bland, so yeah, you think in your mind whatever you want it to taste like. The Gemara Yuma Dafayin Hey has a machlokas, exactly what you were able to do with your mind to affect the man. Are you able only to get it to taste like a certain food, or could you even change its texture? That if you say you want it to be a steak, it would actually turn into a steak. It wasn't just that it would taste like that. So let's assume that you could even change the texture. Let's assume like that shita in Yuma Daf Ayin Hey. So are they let the Achronim discuss? Were they allowed to do that on Shabbos? Were they allowed to think what they wanted the mun to be on Shabbos? I would have thought Pashtus is yes. Otherwise, their Shabbos meals were more bland than all their weekday meals. No, that's the way they had an Onik Shabbos. That we celebrate Hayom Hayom Hayom. We have three meals on Shabbos: Zeichelaman, Lecha Mishnah, Zeichelaman, the challah cover, the thing under that, Zeichelaman. Everything Zeichelaman, Zeichelaman. And the man was terrible on Shabbos. It didn't taste like anything. The rest of the week, it tasted good. Maybe they had to think before Shabbos. They had to prepare, not just to bring the man in, but to prepare what they wanted it to taste like in advance. I don't know. Rav Asher Weiss in Minchas Hashem Ba'al Oscha discusses this, and he says that he's not sure if it was Usher or not. He's Mesupak, whether it was Usher to think, you know, think a type of food on the man. But he says, Pashtus is, if it was Usher, it wouldn't work. Meaning, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not going to like play into your Isser. If it was Usser to do, and then you would think you want it to be a steak, so Hashem's going to say no. Right, you have Mahani, you have Lamani, it's word of Dalit. Yeah. So now, if you have, so if you hold that that's the Vart, that the idea is that anything that's not a Maisa is not a Chol Shabbos, so then that would explain the Urim V'Tumim, that it's not a Maisa. But how that relates back to our situation, meaning to instructing the Amazon Echo, to instructing, what's its name again?
Alexa,
right? To instructing Alexa to do things. So if Dibur is not a Maisa, so then it's not a Maisa. But you can't say that it's automatically Mutter because it's magical. It's not magical. It seems it's cool, but it's not magical. Meaning it scientifically can be explained how this works and why this works. So it's not like you're davening and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is making it happen. It's not like you say a tefillah each time and then HaKadosh Baruch Hu responds to your tefillah by making Alexa work each time. It's something that has a very logical scientific explanation. So the Chara would be subject to that dispute, and then you would need to figure out the role of Dibor, which is its own complicated.
Why is this dissimilar from just like a regular grammar or something? If you tell it to do something, you know it's going to do it.
So that's the question, whether that would be grammar. Meaning, is this considered indirect? If that's its darko bekach, that's the way it's supposed to work.
It's really not as magical as a mystical force that's doing something.
Exactly, right.
You're telling it to do something and you know that it's...
Meaning, it might be worse than grammar. So that's the issue. You know, there's a discussion, the Sefer Geza Yishai. I saw quoted in the Masifta on Baba Kama. He quotes the Sefer Geza Yishai, Marechas Aleph Os Aleph, where he discusses creating a person or an animal with Sefer Yitzira on Shabbos. And if a person is going to use Sefer Yitzira, you see what I'm saying? Like, these are the kinds of makoros they have to use to deal with these Shabbos. So can you create, using Sefer Yetzira, can you create a person on Shabbos through the Frankenstein thing? So he says that since that's the only way to create a person, we don't have another method of making an adult human, you know, out of nothing. The only way to do it is through Sefer Yetzira. So he says it's darko b'kach, and therefore it's a violation of bona. Because that's how do you make people? You make people with Sefer Yetzira. Otherwise, you just don't make people, which is what most of us do. We just don't make people that are adults. But if you were going to make people, the only way to do it is through Sefer Yetzira. So Mela, that's the derech to do it. It's not even considered a shinoi or an unusual way to do it. And Mela, it's an isra of bona. In the Tshuvas Kerem Chemed, also quoted in that same Masifta, in Chelek Aleph Simon Gimel, he disagrees. He says, no. When it comes to Shabbos, the way it works is not just, you know, what's the darko bekach of that item. Anytime you have a malacha of Shabbos, all malachas of Shabbos emanate from Mishkan. And if it wasn't done in the Mishkan and it has nothing to connect it to in the Mishkan, then it's neither an av nor a tolda. It's nothing. It's not a malacha at all on Shabbos. In the Sefer Lev Chaim, Reb Chaim Palagi, in the Chelek Beis Siman Kuf Pei Ches, he agrees with the Geza Yishai that it would be a violation, and initially suggests that if a fire breaks out and you know a certain incantation that you can say that will put the fire out, that maybe you shouldn't be allowed to do that with the skula either. But ultimately he says, no, that's different, because if you're saying certain things, you're saying mizmorei tehillim or something like that, that's just the tarusa milutasa, and it's activating the tarusa de le'ela, meaning it's like a tefillah. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu putting out the fire. It's not you putting out the fire with what you're saying, and therefore Hashem is the one that's doing the actual mechaba, and that would not be a problem. And therefore, at most, it's a grama de grama. Hashem is the one that's reacting to our zechuyos and saying the tehillim, and therefore would not be a problem. None of that would be relevant to something, again, that has a logical explanation, where you're instructing it and it's responding to your instructions based on its wiring, based on the way that the technology is supposed to work. Maybe the better mushel of what this might be about, or what you know, where to find whether this is considered a malacha or not, is the discussion that poskim have about having your dog do malacha for you on Shabbos. Because that already, that's been around for a while. Meaning, well, it might have come in, whether it's a kli that's doing malacha for you. It's not a mir la'akum, because it's not a guy that's doing malacha. But so you have your dog doing malacha for you on Shabbos. I think we once discussed this. A mir la'kelef. You know, you have a... What?
The elevator question.
The elevator question, right. So there was a... So I think I actually got that shiloh from someone. Right, that was a real one. I don't think that was a Zilberstein one. I think someone actually asked me that one. It became Rose. I probably sent it to him, but I think I actually got that shiloh once, where a guy had trained his dog that he knows. He goes into the elevator and he hits the right button on the elevator. So he lives in Manhattan on like the 40th floor or something. So can he just bring his dog with him into the elevator? So over there, it's a double. You know, it's the dog pushing the button on its own. That was that he didn't even have to instruct the dog. He didn't have to say, you know, any command. And even if you do instruct the dog, sometimes it could be whatever you train it. It doesn't have to be in your language. It could be, you know, if you train it to understand certain command, even though it's gibberish. So it wouldn't even be a statement of malacha, meaning there is an issue of daber daver. You're not supposed to be speaking about malacha, but you're not speaking about malacha. You're saying Omaha, and it knows that it's supposed to hit the 40th floor. Someone just told me, Rabbi Storch just told me today, right? He told us that there was a guy, the Chabad Shliach in Montana, right? It was Montana, had to, the state police there had purchased a bomb-sniffing dog or some sort of highly specialized dog from Israel that was trained in Israel, and there was only one problem. It only spoke Hebrew. So the only person that could instruct it to do anything in Montana was the Chabad Shliach in Montana. So they had to call him anytime they needed the dog to do anything before they could retrain it.
How does this relate to the issue of using the microphone
on Shabbos? So it relates a lot to the issue of using a microphone on Shabbos because the thing is loaded with microphones. So we'll get to that in a second. So it may relate to just in terms, these are two separate issues. Using a microphone on Shabbos is stam that it's amplifying your voice. Now, the actual malachos that are being done as a result of that are a whole different level, meaning it's not just that it's amplifying your voice, and what that involves exactly. You know, Soloveitchik had the famous line when the whole microphone dispute broke out about whether you can or can't use a microphone on Shabbos. Certain synagogues wanted to keep a microphone in Shul on Shabbos. So Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Silver told us, Rav Soloveitchik said at the time, all the poskim that are saying that it's usur probably don't know the first thing about physics. And all the people that are saying that it's mutter definitely don't know the first thing about halacha. So you have to have knowledge of both areas in order to actually paskin halacha like that. But there's a tshuva in the Har Tzvi, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, and Aruch Chaim Chelek Aleph, Siman Kufay and Dalid, where he discusses whether you're allowed to hint to your dog to be mechabe a fire on Shabbos. And he suggests that it's even more kal than grama, because there's no maisa bechlal, that it's just doing it for you. So maybe on that level, when something else that is not mitzuva at all is doing something for you, maybe that would not be a violation. Now, there is a din of Shvisas Behema on Shabbos, where Rav Tzvi Frank dismisses that. He doesn't think there's a violation of Shvisas Behema when your animal turns on a light for you. Why is that not a violation of Shvisas Behema? Shvisas Behema is a din that it shouldn't be doing farm work for you. That's what it means. Not that it should, that an animal has lamates malachos and that it can't do anything that you're not allowed to do. That's not the din of Shvisas Behema.
Oh, yeah. We're going a step too far. What about you're turning on the LED light?
Okay, good. So, right, so we'll get to all that. So, meaning, you're right, I'm going to the end game before we're getting to just to activate the whole system. Microphones are listening to you, and the light is immediately turning on. Let's assume, what's her name again? Alexa is mad at you, and she doesn't want to do anything you say. So she's listening, but she's not listening. So she's not listening to anything you say. It still might be a problem, right? So, yeah, good. We're going to discuss all of this. Rabbi Bleich, apparently, based on the literature that was sent to me, quotes a Tosfos Baba Kama and Daf Yud, who quotes Rabbeinu Tam, that if a bunch of people sit on a bench and the bench breaks, all of the people on the bench that break are as culpable as the first guy. And he assumes that their culpability doesn't come from the maisa of sitting down, because when they sat, that didn't do anything until other people sat down afterwards. Their culpability comes from the fact that they were there. Their weight was contributing to it, even though they weren't doing anything. The maisa yeshiva wasn't an act of nezek at all when the first couple of guys sat on the bench. But their continuing to remain there is the act of nezek, and maybe that's enough to be mechayiv them. So the definition of a maisa may be a little more expansive than we're giving it credit for. That it could just be one's presence, but you have to be careful because that's not always the case. You know, to say that just being somewhere is a maisa. Over here, it's one's presence that's affecting something, that's making something happen, that somehow becomes a mice. So the way he says is that anything that produces their effects, not by virtue of force exerted by the body, but its ability to discern the change in the person would not be called a maisa. But if it's force exerted by the body, even if that force is only in the form of gravity of the person's weight, but it's bodily force that's being exerted, so that would be a maisa. So then it would turn out that, you know, that the instructions are certainly thinking when we're dealing with BCI technology would l'chara not be a maisa. Now, the truth is we don't even get this far, because as Natan keeps saying, as soon as you say Alexa, the blue light turns on. So turning on an LED light on Shabbos, what the Isser is exactly is a big discussion. The Poskim, I was just listening to a question and answer session Rav Asher Weiss had in Eretz Yisrael, where he gave a shir about mental illness in Halacha, and then he had like a half hour of question and answer. And someone started the question about an LED with the introduction that since LED is only minhag and it's not even it's a most drabanan, so therefore, and then continued the question. And Rav Asher, like, said, you obviously are not familiar with Minchas Asher Chelek Aleph. You know, he always does that. So you obviously don't know what I wrote in my tshuvas, that I hold that LED lights, turning on LED lights, is Malach Daraisa. Why is it Malach Daraisa? Rav Asher has this phenomenal chiddush about electricity on Shabbos, which really helps in a very great sense, helps us function in today's world where there are things happening and listening and watching wherever you go. And at the same time, is also a tremendous chumrah in other areas. Rav Asher's essential chiddush is, and I'm not doing it justice, but to say it in a minute, his essential chiddush is that there's Yerushalmi that tells us that the malacha of Makkah Bepatish is defined as not really having its own independent definition. Meaning, the way we are trained to think about malacha is you look at an act, you look at any given action, and you say, okay, does that fit into any of the 39 categories? And if it doesn't, then it's not a malacha. So is it Bishul? No. If it doesn't fit into any of the 39 categories, you take out Rabbi Chait's picture book, you look at all the pictures, and it doesn't fit, so then it's not a malacha at all. The Yerushalmi assumes, the way Rav Asher understands it at least, is that Chazal understood that any creative act on Shabbos, any obviously creative act, is a malacha. Most of them will fit into one of the 38 categories. It's like they have 39 boxes they set up. 38 of them are labeled with very specific malachas. You have charish and zareah, you know, very lush and, you know, tochen, all the malachas. So whenever they come up with a creative act, you write it down on a piece of paper, put it in that box. Whenever they come up with a creative act and they go through 38 of them, they say, it doesn't fit any of them, they stick it in the Makkah Bepatish box. But it's a malacha d'oraisa. So anything that's an obviously creative act, he assumes is a malacha d'oraisa. So he says, if you're going to do something that's going to turn on an LED light, in an obvious way, where you see it, that would be a malacha d'oraisa. Now, on the flip side, the tremendous kula that yields is that if it's not a creative act at all, and you're not even doing anything, and you wouldn't even, no one would even know that it's happening. You're just walking down the street, and there may be things that know that you're there, that are sensing, you know, Big Brother or whatever, but it's so removed from you, you're not even doing anything. Well, they never would have called that a malacha. That's not a creative act at all. So that just doesn't fit into the gather of a malacha. So that would help a lot in terms of, you know, you're in a hotel, and let's assume the light would automatically shut off if it senses that you're not there, which means that as you continue to stay there, it's sensing that you're there, and that's why the light is staying on, because it knows that you're there. Yeah, but that's fine. It's not. There's nothing happening that you can see that's obvious because of any actions that you're doing. So he would suggest that would be totally fine. Now over here, you're activating, you're saying Alexa, and then the blue light turns on, you're activating the system. That l'chora is an obvious creative act. Rav Asher would probably say it's Malach d'oraisa. Others would say, well, turning on an LED light is Malach d'rabbanan. Others might say it's a very strong minhag that we don't do. But whatever it is, we don't do it. Whichever category you're going to put it on, we don't do it. And then you also have the issue of leaving microphones on over Shabbos. That it's listening to you. Even when you don't say Alexa, it's listening to you. Because if you... if it knows to listen to the word Alexa, that means it's listening to every other word you said and interpreting it as not saying the word Alexa. So it's the microphones are listening to you and are amplifying in the system. And apparently they're, according to the advertisement I saw on YouTube before I started this year tonight, they're very, very sensitive microphones. Like the All American Family that had the Alexa the Amazon Echo in the ad, were having casual conversation where all they talk about is the Amazon Echo, but they're having a casual conversation about where to keep it, and the dad said, "Oh, it doesn't matter where we keep it; it could hear us anywhere." Trying not to sound creepy, because it does feel a little scared. Wait, it's listening to us everywhere? Yeah, it listens to us everywhere. I mean, it can hear from a very far distance. So it's picking up on voice.
But that's where the cooler would kick in, right?
That not right. That's where Avashra's cooler would kick in. That's true. Now, what is the issue with the microphone in the first place? Meaning, what's the problem of leaving? Why couldn't a shul that's, let's say, a massive shul, Beis Knesset Shel Alexandria Shel Mitzrayim, that the Gemara describes, where they had 1.2 million people there, flying to Mitzrayim, and they had to wave the flags to answer? I mean, could they just put a microphone in and just leave it on before Shabbos? What would be the problem with doing that? So you have different poskim suggest different things. Rav Moshe has a couple of tshuvas where he sort of outlines the issues. I'm not sure all of these issues would relate to an internal microphone that doesn't, that doesn't amplify the sound outward for everybody to hear. For example, the notion of Avsha Milser, Shlomo Zalman talks about, that you shouldn't have noisy appliances, noisy things. The Gemara talks about a mill working over Shabbos, because you don't want noisy things working in your house over Shabbos. That's considered a violation of Shabbos. So, l'chora, with a real microphone, there's an argument to be made, and Rosh Hashanah makes that argument, that it's Avsha Milser. So that was one of the arguments that was made against having a dishwasher on a timer, because dishwashers used to be very loud. Now, a lot of the newer dishwashers are not so loud at all. They're fairly quiet. The reason why you can't set a dishwasher on a timer is a different reason, because every dishwasher, as far as I know, has a safety feature that just shutting the door, or just leaving it, if you just leave it after you load the dishes, it won't turn on even if you set it on a timer. You have to shut the door and lock it, and only then will it turn on. So by you shutting the door, close it, okay, whatever it is, but it has to be in place. You can't leave the door open and have it turn on, meaning so you're activating, you're allowing it to become activated by closing that door. So that to me is the bigger issue with the timer, more than the Avsha Milser, is that you're putting the system into you're putting the process into motion by closing that door or whatever it takes to close it all the way. Obviously, it has to be that it wouldn't turn on if you leave it open, because then they'd get a lot of complaints about flooded homes. So it has to be completely sealed and closed. So, but there were those that argued Avsha Milser, or leaving washing machines running on, from right before Shabbos, or dryers or things like that. So with a microphone, with a real microphone, so you could certainly argue, its whole point is to make noise, is to make things noisier than they should be, louder than they should be. But not when you're dealing with something that's an internal microphone. I don't think that you could argue Avsha and something like that. But Rav Moshe goes with other ideas. Rav Moshe talks about, turning electrical impulses into louder sounds, which I don't know enough about this, whether it's whether it would be a violation. He talks about Gzeir Shemisak and Kleshir, that it's somewhat musical, and therefore, when you deal with a microphone, and therefore maybe it has a din like a clay shear, that Gzeir Hashem Yisakein. I don't know. If it's something that's not made to amplify sound, that's not what it's there to do, even though it does talk back to you. It does say, repeat your command, but it's not amplifying your voice. It's a computer is generating its own its own voice. I don't know. I'm not sure if you have all of these things.
Some of the patients that have hearing aids, they also have.
So hearing aids are microphones, right? So the post can work on that. And what they essentially work on is with the angle of Kavod Abrios, battle to their own body. It's in them. It's not for the whole world. It's only that, that kind of thing. But you're saying for the person themselves, Yeah, but there's no person on the other end over here. There's no person listening on the other end. Yeah. I'm saying this should be even better. This should be even better, L'chora, because there's no person even hearing it. I mean, again, the reason we're making with hearing aids is covered in brios. It's very embarrassing not to be able to hear things all the time. And that the post can use a lot of creativity to be makel with that, because there's a major tzorech to be makel with the hearing aids. I doubt you would try to come up with the same shas hadchak. You know, someone was saying, one of the articles I found online, that, you know, I'm tone deaf. It would be really nice if, as I started trying to sing these emer, the Alexa would help out and play the background music to keep me on key singing the zemer. I don't think that rises to a shas hadchak. I don't know if that's. Oh, so the real bottom line of all this, every time something like this comes out, is you see how wise Rav Moshe was. You know, when I was younger and we started learning about timers and things like this, and, you know, you always had Rav Moshe in the backyard. Rav Moshe said, you can only use timers where it's already Nahug and some lights, it's already the Minug, but nowhere else, because Shabbos is just going to become like a weekday, because you'll always be able to work around with timers and everything will run like a weekday. And I always thought, like, Shabbos is not going to be like a weekday. There's nothing. But, like, you really see his the foresight that he had in realizing where this can go. That if you're just going to allow things that you can't do yourself to be done through some sort of shtick, through whether it be with a timer, whether it be with something, that ultimately is going to be the greatest Zilzul Shabbos. So that prediction of Rav Moshe is, he had a prediction about microwaves that didn't exactly come true. So it's not like he was a Navi, but that he was certainly Chacham. He thought in one of the early tshuvas about microwaves, he said, you know, pretty talking about whether it's bishul or not in terms of asa b'cholov, in terms of Shabbos, whether it constitutes bishul. He says, pretty soon, you know, this thing is amazing, and no one's going to have ovens anymore. Like, this is just going to be how people cook. So he was wrong about that, at least for now. But in terms of the idea about predicting where Shabbos is going to go if we allow this kind of thing, so he was very much on the ball. About that, and I would think that would be the in addition to everything else, that's why it's really like a non-starter. That it's just such a Zilzul Shabbos that everything is gonna, you know. On the other hand, like, where do you draw the line on Zilzul Shabbos? I'm told that Rabbi Sabalovsky Shlita doesn't like the Shabbos lamps. What are the Shabbos lamps? You're just taking a piece of wood and putting it in front of the light. I mean, that's all it is. It's just built in with the mechanism. So now someone came out with another type of Shabbos lamp that's built into the bulb, where the bulb itself has a shade built into the bulb. So you can go over to each light bulb in the room and just flick the shade that's built into the bulb, and the lights will all turn off and you can turn them on, but nothing's happening electronically. All you're doing is you're moving the shade. It's just that it's built into to the bulb. And of what utility is that? Like, why is that important? You go to a hotel somewhere and you want to have light for your meal. You're eating in the room, but then you want to be able to go to sleep at night. So it's always, you're never sure what to do. So you can bring a Shabbos clock, a timer. So it's much easier. Just screw in the bulb beforehand, and then you can turn it on and off as you please. So that's my in-laws told me they stayed at a hotel in Israel that was recently built. And they said they were nervous because they hit Shabbos mode on the room before Shabbos started, and they were nervous that 3 hours after Shabbos started, the lights were still on in the room. But then, like, 3 hours after Shabbos started, the lights turned off. They turned on again for the last 3 hours of Shabbos. Like, it just has this. But most hotels in the world don't have that. They're not in Israel. So anyway, at the end of the day, I think what we're going to discover is that you'll have a lot of halachic, fascinating halachic discussion about this, and at the end of the day, you're not going to be allowed to do anything different on Shabbos anyway. Okay.